let me put a quote on there, if I could have you hit the whole screen. Thank you. This is from someone named Ambrose Gwinnett Bierce, who is some writer in the turn of the 20th century. But he wrote, he wrote, "Insurance, an ingenious modern game of chance in which the player is permitted to enjoy the comfortable conviction that he is beating the man who keeps the table." And, of course, you know, we all pay, I think it's hard to avoid not paying some kind of insurance of some type. And really, you're putting money into a pot that you hope you never really have to pull out from, because events that lead to you having to call on insurance can be pretty dramatic and pretty, I guess, painful, if you will. So, and always, there's always the case where the insurance company may not pay you. They may not supposedly call it honor the contract if you have done something outside of that contract. So it really can be a game of chance, if you will. And so it's important that when we talk about insurance that we sort of have a good understanding about all the pros and cons and some of the pitfalls that are out there. I want to talk a little bit about risk management. Again, insurance and crew contracts and dealing with all that stuff falls into the category of risk management. And risk management is basically, if I could sum it up, it's taking a look at your business in its entirety and determining where all your risks lie. And then once you've identified all your potential risks, determine how you're going to deal with each one of those. You know, we talked in previous classes about a SWOT analysis: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats, where you look at your business or proposed business and you try to capture, you know, a good general casting of what all the pros and cons are. Well, when you look at the weaknesses and the threats of a SWOT analysis, you're really starting to identify your risks. And of course, as you go through your business plan and your business, you're going to deal with those risks. And fisheries is not different from any other business. You have significant risks in it, and they can deal with the marketing side of things. You know, perhaps you're going to lose a buyer, and so that's an important thing to deal with. What do you do if your one market is going away? You can look on the financial side and evaluate all your risks that you have. Perhaps the price is simply too low for fish this year, and it doesn't pencil out to go fishing. You know, that is something that you need to deal with. And I think more importantly, and certainly more on point with today's conversation, is risk within your productions and operations system. And in fishing, there are significant risks, topped off with safety for your crew and yourself and for your boat. Okay, those are big things you have to deal with. And you know, there's risks in keeping the food quality up to par. Dealing with injuries and all kinds of things that come along are very important. So with risks, you can deal with them a couple different ways. And this is sort of just a list here. You can avoid them, right? You can mitigate them. You can keep them and deal with them, or you can transfer them off. Okay. Now, avoiding a risk is, you know, for instance, say you're involved in a couple different fisheries, and you know that one of them is simply not going to pencil out this year. Maybe you just don't go and do it. Now, you're avoiding risk because you don't want to take a financial loss on that, but you are you're not making any money on it either. Running a business is about taking on risks and profiting from those risks. And so if you avoid them altogether, then you stand to lose money. Pretty obvious. But sometimes if you realize it's not going to pencil out, then you shouldn't be doing it. Mitigating risks, you know, a good example in fisheries would be, you know, there's the risk of sinking or safety to the crew. And a good way to deal with that, it may happen, it may well happen. And a good way to deal with that is to have all the appropriate equipment, safety equipment on board, and have everyone trained in what to do in case of an emergency so that everyone knows what to do. You're taking on a risk, you're dealing with it as best you can, and so you're going to handle it when it comes up. Retaining risks might be you're willing to accept them and the costs of those risks. Okay, it could be something like perhaps food quality might be a risk. You realize that if you go and you fish at a certain area, you may not be able to get the product back in time in order to provide the highest quality product possible, and you'll suffer in the price at that point. But you're going to deal with that. Perhaps you have an RSW system that may be close to failing, but you're still going to go and fish on it. And if it fails, you'll have a diminished product in terms of quality, and you're going to deal with that risk, and you're going to absorb the losses. Self-insuring is an example of retaining risk. Transferring risk really gets the issue of insurance. You are buying an insurance policy where, in the case of an expensive accident or something like that, you will you have, someone else will cover the cost of that, or at least you're planning for them to cover the cost of that. And of course, the thing about insurance is it's perceived transfer of risk, because you may not get the insurance company to cover you, or you're certainly going to pay a deductible, so you do have still have some risk involved. But at least it's a comfort in certain areas, and when you get with lenders and things like that, it's required in places. So those are just some general categories under risk management, and it is a topic all in of itself, and deserves a lot more time than we have for it today. Okay, couple quick notes on the kinds of people that you deal with in the insurance industry. Pretty obvious stuff here, but I thought I'd cover it real quick. First one is an underwriter, and that's really the insurance company, if you will. An underwriter is an entity or a person who understands the costs associated with insuring a certain sector, whatever it is. They know how much they need to charge in terms of premiums. They know if they should even insure them to begin with. Okay, now, I remember a number of years ago, people were having significant trouble getting insurance if they had a wooden boat, and it was a horrible problem for people. I think at some point, insurance companies just didn't want to insure that kind of operation, so that can be a problem. Inside these companies, you may find high-tech accountants called actuaries who are very good at analyzing risk, and so that is an art of itself. But that's your basic insurance company. Now, the people who you may deal with and contact can be brokers or agents. Brokers should be independent operators who are finding the best insurance company for you and really representing you as a client. Agents generally represent the insurance company themselves. Okay, they're trying to sell those specific products. And adjusters are the folks that will come through at the end of the day after an accident has occurred, and try to understand what went wrong and determine what's the appropriate payout for that. Now, adjusters can work for insurance companies, or they can be third party, or they can work for you. You know, it really just depends. But ultimately, there may be a battle of adjusters at certain points along the way. Okay, here's just some types of insurance for a fishing operation. You see these pretty commonly provided by folks out there. The first one, hull and machinery, is really protecting your boat. And everything is sort of nailed down or screwed down on it, okay? And it's there to protect you in the case of sinking or perhaps collision, fire, that kind of thing. So that really protects your boat. It's generally based on the value of your boat that's received from a marine survey. And so that's how the whole machinery cost is determined. It's usually a percentage of the market value of your boat. It's very important. Got to have it. Protection and indemnity is the other big one. P&I, it's referred to. And this is really the insurance. It's like liability insurance and other kinds of insurance packages. But P&I will protect you in the case where you are negligent or your operation is negligent and has caused an accident or injury. Okay, it's really the messy area, if you will, of all of this. And as we've seen from examples, and we'll talk about a little bit here, there's a wide array of things that can come at you, even if you haven't seemingly been negligent. Courts have shown the ability in the past to find captains negligent of things, very surprising instances. And so it's important to have enough P&I to cover accidents. P&I is generally based on how many crew you have, and so you'll pay X amount to protect these individuals out there. But there's, of course, other things that can happen to an operation. I'll read a couple things that P&I policies may assist you in. They pay the maintenance and cure for sick and injured crew, and we'll talk about maintenance and cure here in a little bit. Pay your defense costs for personal injury lawsuits. Pay to repair damages caused by your vessel to another vessel, equipment, or facility. And pay for death and injury to people caused by your boat. And pay for the removal of the wreck and abatement of pollution caused by the wreckage of your vessel if required by authorities. So it covers a number of things, and a lot of these things are hard to put a price tag on. So P&I can be pretty expensive. I had a conversation with a gentleman out in Bristol Bay a couple weeks ago, and he has been and I didn't help him out much, but he's been unsatisfied with understanding exactly how much P&I he should get for his operation. It's been hard for him to get anyone to give him a definitive answer. In my conversations with people and in listening to folks, I had one gentleman who runs an insurance pool had said this, as well as a maritime lawyer that I had talked to in the past, you want at least $1 million these days in P&I protection, which sure seems significant. A lot of the P&I claims are going to be pretty small numbers, you know, perhaps less than $100,000. And so to have $1 million stocked away or available when those are the size of the claim seems a little frustrating, but if you do get hit with something in excess of $1 million, once they've exhausted the P&I, they're going to go ahead and get your boat, get your permit, and if that doesn't take you very far, then they're going to go ahead and get your house and your retirement, your car. So it's very important to have an adequate P&I. Breach of warranty is something that in insurance that you might need to get if you have a lien holder on your boat. A lender may want you to have it. Now, breach of warranty is insurance for them to protect their investment in you. So let's say protect them in the event you aren't able to claim on your normal insurance. Apologies for that. So here's an example of it. Let's say in your insurance policy for your hull and machinery, you say you're just going to fish in Southeast Alaska, but something comes up and you zip into the Bering Sea. Okay, I know that sounds silly, but let's just say for some reason you're fishing outside of your area as prescribed by your hull and machinery policy. If something happens to your boat there, let's say it sinks, the insurance company doesn't have to cover you because that's outside of your policy. And therefore, the lien holder, the lender, may not get their vessel mortgage payment back. I mean, you're not going to pay them if you're all out of the money. So the breach of warranty insurance allows them to get paid by the insurance company, at least up to the point of their mortgage. And then, of course, the insurance company can come after you if they want for failure to adhere to your policies. Cargo insurance is essentially insuring those items that aren't nailed down that could get lost from sinking and lost maybe from theft or from fire, something like that. It could be your gear. It could be your supplies. Tender vessels may choose to insure fish in the hold. So that's just various things that can be insured with cargo. Pollution is one I added just recently. You know, again, we talked about P&I covering pollution costs, but if your P&I coverage doesn't do that, you may need to get pollution insurance too, which comes from government fines related to sinkings of vessels. You know, if the government may want you to pull your vessel off the bottom of the ocean floor, and also fine you for the leaked fuel from that. So there's all kinds of risks out there, and these are some of the types of insurances that you find in fishing. Okay, here's some types of providers that you have out there. Again, probably nothing you haven't seen already, but we'll just cover them in the event you haven't. Now, insurance companies are pretty standard forms of providers for insurance. You can Google up commercial fishing, marine insurance, and you'll get a number of different businesses that offer this, so it's not too hard to find. It may be hard to find someone who's going to insure your operation, but there are plenty of insurance companies out there. You can self-insure, and we talked about this a little bit before. Self-insuring can be kind of risky. You have to have adequate funds to cover these things. Now, self-insuring for hull and machinery might be one route. If you know the value, the replacement value of your boat, you could insure that. May not be too problematic. It could be upwards of $200,000, $300,000. But trying to self-insure for P&I could be a dangerous area. I mean, you may need $1 million sitting in the bank in case something really bad happens, and that may not be enough either. So, I'm not sure I know many people who have $1 million to sit around in the bank waiting to get sued. So it's kind of a difficult area, but people certainly could do it. Insurance pools is kind of like self-insuring, but it's where a number of like-minded fishermen will come together, put in some funds, and create a bigger fund with which they will all use to deal with claims in the future. So essentially you've got a well-managed pot of money that is pulled on by the members. One of the things about insurance pools that I've heard from people is that they're going to be risk-averse. They're not going to want to have individuals enter their pool who they think are potential risks, right? Because if you lose your boat and the fund is going to take a hit by that amount, okay, so if you're someone who has a bad track record, who may be perceived as reckless by other people in the fleet, you may have trouble getting into insurance pool. It's a good reason to keep a clean maintenance record on your boat and to keep a good safety record. So pools can be very good for folks that are involved in them. And the final one is a government can provide insurance policies. I don't know of any insurance policies right now for the fishing industry, but it's certainly prevalent in the agriculture industry through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. When I first heard the term risk management used, it was actually when USDA was looking at getting crop insurance type coverage for the fishing industry, and the agency that handles crop insurance is called the Risk Management Agency. And so that's actually a pretty common form of insurance in the agricultural field, and they insure not only for crop failure or for disaster to their crops, but they also insure for market risks, you know, not getting the price that's going to make their operation pencil. So no such luck here for commercial fisheries at this point. Okay, a little bit about the Fisherman's Fund, and again, I have this handout that's in your resources section that is a lot more informative than what I'll do here today. But to the extent that you haven't heard of the Fisherman's Fund, this will be a good introduction. The Fisherman's Fund is a pot of money that is administered by the Alaska Department of Labor. And the pot of money is created by fees from permits and from crew member licenses that come into the state through the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And I also believe the Department of Fish and Game handles the crew member license fees. At any rate, the fund itself is managed by a board of directors made up of fishermen from around the state, and it's there to cover fishing injuries, okay? And there's limits to what it'll cover. And so you have to go and talk to them about how much they'll cover for certain kinds of injuries. It's also the payee of last resort, meaning that they're going to want to make sure you've exhausted all your pre-existing coverage areas, the other insurance policies that you have, be it P&I or your own personal health insurance or whatever it is. They're going to make sure that those things have already been dealt with before they'll pay. So they aren't the do-all in covering injuries. See, they're just a good resource, and they can help you out with a couple thousand dollars here and there. So please keep them in mind. And if you get to the point where if you haven't studied up on them, I'd encourage you to do so, because they do have some rules you're going to need to follow, and those are pretty darn important. All right, I want to talk a little bit about some tips for lowering your insurance bill. And when I look at these, I don't get the feeling that they are all that warm and fuzzy on the subject. There is, you know, we're sort of dealing with a dour side of fishing, that is minimizing your risks through insurance and liabilities that come from crews. And I think that these tips are really more about helping you maintain your current costs of insurance and making sure that they don't rise. You know, to the extent that your insurance costs fall, that's fantastic. But I mean, realistically, I think these are things you can do to make sure it doesn't become a bigger expense in the future. And these are pretty common sense things to keep in mind. The first one that you hear is have a good safety record. Make sure you've got all the right equipment. Make sure that you run the drills. Make sure that you haven't missed any inspections with the Coast Guard, and be able to demonstrate yourself as a safe bet out on the sea. That's really important for your insurance purposes. Keep your vessel maintained and in good working order. Okay, and at the same time, try to have a vessel layout that makes sense, that is safe. If you've got a vessel where your crew's always bonking their head on things or slipping and falling, that's going to lead to more injuries and more claims on you, and that may lead to higher premiums in the future. So do the best you can in setting up your vessel so that it is a safe place to work, and that your machinery runs smoothly and everything goes well as you can. If you can get involved in an insurance pool, that may really be a good way to lower your insurance bill. I've talked to some folks who in some years they may be expected to pay a little bit to beef up the fund, and some years they don't. And in some years their fund is actually set up to pay them back money if they earn enough interest on the fund. You know, it's going to be a set amount. Let's just say it's $10 million is in the fund for 50 fishermen. And then let's say they've determined $10 million is the right amount. If interest on that account increases to a certain point, they get paid a dividend from that. And so that can actually be a pretty attractive thing. At the very least, though, an insurance pool is one of the better ways that I've heard of folks minimizing their insurance bill. So look for that and see if you can find, if you're not in one, see if you can find some help in that category. The next one, marine survey, is a little cheesy, but it's the thought is, if you think the value of your boat has gone down, maybe have a marine survey done again. And if the market value of your boat's gone down, then that's less hull and machinery you're going to pay. Remember that hull and machinery is based on a percentage of your vessel value, and so if your boat costs less, or if it's worth less, then you'll pay less. It's sort of an odd little idea, but it could work. Raising your deductible may be a way of lowering your premium costs. Now, deductibles, of course, is the amount you need to pay in case of an accident. It's the amount you need to pay before the insurance will kick in. So if right now your deductible is at $2,000, meaning that if there's an accident that costs you $10,000, you got to pay the first $2,000, and the insurance company will pay you the $8,000. Let's say you raise your deductible to $5,000, meaning you're going to pay that first $5,000, and then they'll pay the rest of the $5,000. That will lower your premium costs. So if you find your premium is just out of control, you're a safe bet, and you don't perceive any major accidents, and you have enough self-insurance perhaps to cover that deductible, you may want to push for that. Not a bad idea. And finally, know the medical condition, the pre-existing medical condition of your crew. Okay, understand where their old injuries lie, and so that you know in case that they come with a claim against you and for an injury, you may know whether or not it's been something that's been an injury in the past. It may not absolve the claim on you, but it may help you a lot. So know the pre-existing medical condition of your crew. Okay, I want to shift gears just a little bit and talk about crew and the skipper's liability. We had mentioned the term maintenance and crew earlier when we talked about P&I insurance. And maintenance and crew really says that as the captain of the vessel, you are responsible not only for the healing, for the cure of who gets injured on board of your crew, but also for their maintenance up to that point, to where they're back and ready, which can be quite costly. So, for instance, say you're in the beginning of July, and you plan on fishing through July and August, and one of your crew members snaps his leg and breaks it and has a two-month healing process, you're going to have to pay all the medical costs associated with the cast and the healing of the broken bone. You also may be responsible to pay for lost wages during that time as well. So that can be very costly, and you need to be prepared to do that. So it's not just fixing the broken bone, it's all the costs associated with that along the way. And if someone is permanently disabled, meaning they can't work for the rest of their lives, the cost may be extraordinary for you, well in excess of $1 million. And that's where you get to the really scary territory. And that can happen on a big boat or a small boat, doesn't really matter. But it could be significant. And only in cases of gross negligence or intentional injury on the crew member's part may you be found not liable for that. And even still, I've heard that that's not a... those can be tough to prove. And even sometimes in cases where it's seemingly obvious that an individual has been negligent, the captain can still get hit with a significant claim. So there's no sure bets in this game of chance. So labor laws, and there are a few out there, and I've only noted a couple here, but there's a number of things we can talk about with labor laws. And again, the Department of Labor has put out this one flyer I've got, this frequently asked questions on wage and hour facts. It may or may not be useful to you, but that does talk about some of these requirements. This document here, again, it's online in the resources section. A couple things though about a crew. The crews are considered self-employed, and until you have more than 10 crew, they are going to be considered self-employed for the purposes of taxation and for the purposes of a lot of labor laws. So, as someone who is self-employed, they're not going to get paid overtime, for instance. Excuse me. You can deduct a number of things from their final from their final paycheck. So there's a lot of things about being self-employed that sort of take them out of that category of a regular employee, especially all the filings that you're going to have to do if you have regular employees. Now, according to Labor, Department of Labor, the contract is necessary and required. It claims the federal government and the state government require a contract. So if you don't have one, that's reason enough, I think, to go out and get one put together. And that should be the minimal reason to do it. A contract is really important because it lays out a number of critical factors that your crew deserve to know as well in advance. Okay, so it's pretty important. Transportation may be an issue. You may, as a captain or skipper or owner of a boat, in some claims be required to cover transportation if it wasn't clearly laid out, clearly developed in a contract form. You know, these are things that you don't want to get into a, you know, sort of a adjudicated process and not really know how things are going to ferret out if you haven't really resolved them or set them down in a contract. Now, as I mentioned, we have a sample crew contract on the Marine Advisory Program website and also in the resources section. But here's just some things that you want to have in a contract, and I've touched on a lot of these previously, but let's go ahead and review them again. First one is the condition of the crew, okay, the medical condition of the crew, and you may want to have some kind of medical disclosure form that accompanies that so that you've got yourself really, really ironed out on that. I hope it's not in opposition to a long-standing relationship you've had with a crew. You know, sometimes they can become kind of like family, I know. But it's still important to have a good handle on this. Okay, accidents can happen. So know exactly what the medical condition of your crew is. It's good to have in writing what kind of deductions you're going to take out of crew share. You know, I've talked to a few folks this last summer who have finally started deducting fuel from the crew share just because of the high cost of fuel. They just had to do it. And I sure hope that didn't come as a shock to the crew. So, you know, on your contract, you can list out what things will be deducted from crew share, if anything. And if there's anything, I'd point that out as well. Contracts can address how you'll handle retro and bonus payments from the processor. I mean, are they going to get a share of those? Is the crew going to get a share of that when it comes through 3 to 6 months down the road? That's good to let them know. It can address how you'll handle travel costs. Perhaps you'll handle travel costs once they're in the employment of the boat and anything related to that that you'll cover. I mean, that would be a good thing for them to know. Will they be paid in the event of no fishing? So, you know, perhaps the gentleman, a crew member, was working in your yard for a month before the fishery started and there was a management closure and no fish were caught. Are you going to be able to compensate them in some way for that? Okay, that's kind of important. Also, this issue of payment before and after the fishing season. You know, are you going to cover the shoulder work of the pre and post activities related to fishing? Another thing, if you're getting involved in a direct market operation, it might be interesting to determine and write out how you're going to pay them, because that could be a little bit different too. Direct market operation, the money could come quite a bit later, you know, as you move your inventory out in time, and those individuals may be wanting to see some revenue right away. So that's something that you may want to work out if you're in a direct market operation. Last two items include alcohol and drug use. You know, to what level do you permit it off the boat? And certainly what will happen if they're found with alcohol and drugs on the boat and while you're operating? So those are very important things. And also gear. Will you be covering gear? Will it be their expense? Maybe you'll cover a portion of it. You know, that's just something that's kind of helpful for folks to know in advance and to get laid out in advance of fishing. Okay, well, as I thought, that's sort of the information I have for the class today.